Welcome to a podcast of Beyond the Book, a presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center. Copyright Clearance Center is the world's largest provider of copyright compliance solutions through a wide range of innovative licensing services and comprehensive educational programs for authors, publishers, and their audiences in academia, business, and research institutions. For more information about Beyond the Book and Copyright Clearance Center, please go to www.beyondthebook.com.
My name is John Chu, Manager of Literature Resources at Gilead Sciences. Thank you for staying to the bitter end of the, I understand, the sixth session of copyright in this year's SLA. I think that kind of broke a record because from what I recall, two to three at most. So I guess that shows the interest and attention that the copyright is being paid to these days. Again, copyright answers for the information professionals, and this is room 708. So if you came to the wrong place, please just, you know, leave. But
or stay,
yes. just a little bit about objectives, and the title, of course, is called Copyright Answers of the Information Professionals. Now, I'd like to just get a show of hands. How many of you are the sponsor, division, member, Pharmaceutical Health Technology? Well, that's interesting, about one-third. I guess we're drawing other divisions. That's great. I initially wanted perhaps to focus the questions more appropriate for the pharmaceutical industry, but then since two-thirds of you are not, let's throw that out. the logistics will be, we have two speakers, and Bill, you will go first, and Leslie second, and then I have a series of questions I collected through emails, pre-submitted, and I generally categorize them to six different or five different areas. And I'll start at the end, questions, and we'd like to rotate. I ask the panelists one question, and then somebody asks from the audience, and then I'll ask the second question. And Bill, you told me it's about 20, 25 minutes, and then Leslie, 15, 20 minutes. So we got plenty of time for questions. Okay? Thank you. So let me introduce Bill Berger, our first speaker. Bill is the Vice President of Marketing at CCC. Everybody know what CCC is, right? Okay, great. And he's been there, joined the senior management team in 2005, and he leads CCC's product marketing and marketing communications group. Prior to that, Bill's first career was in journalism, and he spent 14 years as an editor, writer, and foreign correspondent at Newsweek. We all know what Newsweek is, of course, right? And after that, he had careers within the industry such as AT&T, and concentrating on K-12 and consumer markets for e-library research service. I think I'd like to know what that is, if you could explain that. And over the years, Bill has helped several companies launch new services for the consumer and business markets, including Rogers Medical Intelligence Solutions. And, of course, those of us in the drug companies, we know what Rogers is, obviously. Bill holds a BA in political science from Stanford, and he served on the board of directors of Stanford Alumni Association. And he lives in Andover, Massachusetts, with his wife and three children. I understand that you are very close to the CCC headquarters, distance-wise,
yes.
Right?
Okay. So it's this is incredible at the tail end to see this many people in the room. It's very heartening. There have been a number of programs this week around copyright. It's good to see some familiar faces from some of those programs and a lot of new faces as well. So I think John teed up the issue. Well, I just wanted to talk about a couple of the current issues in copyright. I should also say at this point that I welcome questions during the course of this presentation. So if you want to ask anything, please just raise your hand, stand up, shout it out, and it'll be we'll talk about it then. So just wanted to list a few of the current issues in copyright these days. Orphan Works is certainly one. There's proposed legislation again in this Congress. There was legislation in the 109th Congress that's been reintroduced, and I think that there's a reasonable hope that there'll be some Orphan Works legislation passed in the next, can you hear me all right? Orphan Works legislation passed in this Congress, and I think for the first time that there's a growing consensus around where that issue is going to go. Open access is a much talked about issue. Certainly people in the scientific and STM content space or consumers of that content are interested in that. That's partly a copyright issue. It's also partly a business issue. But I'll just mention it here. Section 108 study group, this is one area that I'm not going to speak on because I really don't have a lot of personal knowledge on that, but I put it up here. I suspect a number of you are caring about it, although it tends to be perhaps more of an issue in the academic library than the corporate library. How many are corporate librarians in this? Okay. Any academic librarians in the room? A handful. Okay. And congressional hearings on P2P file sharing, there was a hearing yesterday in Washington. The House Judiciary Committee talking to a number of leaders of academic institutions and really holding their feet to the fire on primarily music file sharing, peer-to-peer music file sharing. The RIAA, as you know, is suing about 400 students a month, asking for settlements of $3,000 per student. And there's a lot of controversy and really quite a lot of passion around that issue. And so those hearings were going on just yesterday. Beyond that, there's a tremendous amount of public interest in a range of issues around copyright, and these headlines are pretty representative. You could find this almost any week in Time from the newspapers and magazines and online content covering the general business press. And in a way, some of these issues have even moved very much into the popular realm because of the kind of consumer nature of YouTube, of Google, and where some of these copyright issues are actually coming into the public realm. And perhaps never before have copyright issues been discussed in such a public fashion as they are today. Much of that has to do with Google, and so many of these headlines, it really reflects the fact that Google has taken a very, very conscious approach in the last couple of years to pursuing what they view as their fair use rights, because their business is largely dependent upon a favorable fair use analysis for them. So that ability to essentially copy and index content from the web so that they can then direct their users to that content is really critical to them. Google Book Search they view as an extension, merely an extension of that. The publishers and some of the authors obviously take a slightly different view there. So just representative of what's going on in terms of copyright. The real question is, why is that happening? Why suddenly in the last 2 years have copyright issues hit the front page, whereas 15, 20 years ago, it was difficult to find anybody who talked about copyright, certainly in the public realm. Well, there are a few reasons for that. The first, of course, is the explosive growth of content and of users on the Internet. And we've got 1 billion Internet users today on the Internet, and just 11 years ago, it was only 48 million. So that's just tremendous growth. That many more people consuming and increasingly creating content. And the amount of content that's being created is astonishing. In 2006, the amount of content equaled 3 million times all of the books ever written, the amount of content created and copied on the web in a single year. Within 6 years, the estimate is that that number that number will increase sixfold. So just think of the speed with which content's being created. And a couple of statistics there. Can you imagine? It takes 5 years to read the scientific material produced every 24 hours. So catch up on that reading. There's an increasing pace of technological and business innovation. Web 2.0 is not just a buzzword. It's really a set of technologies that are now very easily deployed and used by people who do not necessarily have a technical background. It's a little difficult to create a website, but it's very easy to create a blog. The tools are just there, and you just pretty much go in, read it, start your blog, and you can be going in 15 minutes. And really, that's what Web 2.0 is about. Web 2.0 is about tools that make it very easy to create content, to share content, to put content to use, to aggregate content from various sources so that you can bring it together and really consume it in the way you want. In the early phases of the Internet, there was a discussion about the daily me. It was this is when the internet was called the information superhighway, and the Daily Me was this notion that you could create a newspaper that was about your interests only. So if you didn't care about sports or gardening or business or whatever, you didn't have to read that stuff. Now there was a lot of criticism. Some people thought that was a dangerous thing, that it wouldn't let new topics come in. But the Daily Me in the first incarnation of the web never really happened, but it really has happened in the second incarnation of the web, because a lot of tools such as RSS allow you to take that content that you want and very quickly consume it and organize it. The increasing bandwidth is certainly given rise to YouTube and other forms of multimedia content, and ad-supported business models again have encouraged the creation of individually created content, because Google's AdSense program and others can now attach ads to specific pieces of content where there is genuine relevance between the content and the ad. So ad-supported content creation is now available and viable for the individual creator. Certainly that was not the case even 5 years ago. As a result of this, the one-to-many publishing model has broken down for many people, and you see the pain that some of the traditional newspaper publishers, magazine publishers, STM publishers are feeling. That one-to-many model is certainly under challenge from a lot of the many-to-many models. And content and software are inextricably linked into tools of knowledge discovery. So the old "we publish it, you read it" paradigm is really been changed fundamentally by that ability of many, many people to create the content and for that content to be found virtually anywhere through the power of the search engines today. So niche publishing is a business model that never could have existed prior to a lot of the tools that we have today. So that's really what's driving all that interest in copyright. Just a couple of words about CCC. I suspect that most of you know who we are, but I just wanted to, for those who didn't, give just a little bit of background. We've been around since 1978. We're a not-for-profit company. We were set up at the suggestion of the United States Congress following the writing of the Copyright Act of 1976, which certainly changed the landscape for copyright, created a new set of rules around the use and reuse of copyright. So we were created. As I said, we're not-for-profit. And we're the reproduction rights organization for the United States. What that really means is we're one of about 30 or so RROs around the world, primarily in the major industrial countries, that have set up a mechanism through bilateral agreements to exchange rights and royalties so that it gives our customers here in the United States access to a vast array of content from around the world, does the same thing for the customers of other RROs in other countries who have access to content published here. And we're the world's largest provider of text licensing and permission services. Our mission is very simple. It's to make it easy for content users to do the right thing. We're trying to remove barriers to licensing. We're trying to create markets where people can easily purchase the rights and permissions they need, because we know that thanks to a lot of these technologies, thanks to the explosive growth of content, people use content differently than they did even 10, 15, 20 years ago. The tools are there to use it, the collaborative tools. Companies are spending a lot of money on collaborative tools. Collaborative tools are no good without content that you can collaborate around. So we're really all about creating those new markets for content and the new ability to share content. And we're also increasingly trying to provide some tools to help customers manage and understand their rights. We've introduced a product called RightSphere. I'll talk about that just a little bit at the end. And again, it's a tool that we hope will help some of our larger corporate customers kind of work through the questions that their employees tend to have. And of course, in doing all this, you have to keep up with technological change. We have corporate licensing services, so the kinds of services the people in this room are using or benefiting from. We have annual copyright licenses. It's really a blanket license for use internally within an organization of all of the content that we represent through our repertory. That includes digital and photocopy uses. We have various pay-per uses for permissions or licenses that are needed for uses that are not covered by the annual copyright license, or perhaps for companies that have not purchased the annual copyright license. We have desktop solutions. RightSphere is an example of that. And we do a lot of educational work. The fact that there have been 6 programs here at SLA with information professionals that have drawn significant numbers of people to hear more about copyright is indicative of the widespread interest in the topic. And we've been running Copyright 101 webinars for our clients, and we launched that 6 or 9 months ago, and we thought, well, maybe we could do one a month or something like that. There might be a little bit of interest in that. We can't keep up. People are just calling us all the time, handing us cards. We'd like a webinar at our organization. So it's really become quite an interesting new thing that we're doing. On the academic side, that's primarily been a pay-per-use business. This is course packs, e-reserves, interlibrary loan, the kinds of essentially supplemental uses of information that are used in the academic setting. And we've tried to integrate some of those permissions into other platforms so that people don't have to leave their ILL or e-reserves workflow in order to get the permission. So we'll integrate with other people to help them make that easy. And we also do a lot of on-site educational work on campuses around the country. So let's bring it back to... John, just a sip of water here. Bring it back to the topic of copyright. So the purpose of intellectual property laws, of which copyright is one, patents are really the other big area of intellectual property, is it's very simple. The purpose was intended to protect and promote creative and inventive works. No, I'm fine with the bottle, thanks. And the quote here is actually from the United States Constitution. So the founders were thinking about this in the 1780s. And they gave a lot of thought to this, and they had a very clear sense that intellectual property, the work of the mind as opposed to the work of creating physical things, was valuable and in that it needed to be protected. But they also noted that it was different from physical property because, obviously, more than one person can take advantage of intellectual property at a time, whereas if you own a house, only one person can really own and live in a house at a time. So there is a difference, and for the limited times, was part of the was part of Congress's the founders' answer to that dilemma. And they certainly had a precedent. 1710, the Statute of Anne went into effect in England. This is generally viewed as the first copyright law in the world, and passed during the reign of Queen Anne. That's the name. So what does U.S. copyright law do? It essentially, it's a few very simple things. It protects the authors of original works of authorship, covers published and unpublished works. That was not always so. The new Copyright Act in 1976, not so new today, but it did change the rules of the game so that, in fact, content was copyrighted from the moment of creation and fixation, writing it down or taking the photograph. And it used to be that you had to actually publish the content and, in fact, in some cases, even prior to that, register your copyright. You no longer had to have to do some of those things. That's really referred to as the elimination of the formalities around copyright that were instituted in that Copyright Act and also by virtue of the United States signing the Berne Convention after almost a century of refusing to do so. Copyright grants the copyright holder exclusive rights to do a number of things for a limited time. That's that kind of bargain that, that Congress and the founders were trying to get at, or to authorize others to do so. And it protects works created on or after January 1st of 1978 until 70 years after the owner's death. When the Constitution was written and the first copyright law was enacted, you were protected for 14 years, not after your death, 14 years from creation, plus you could register for another 14 years if you wanted to extend that protection. Over the last 200 years, and most of that in the last 100 years or so, that term has been extended by Congress on a number of occasions. And there's a fair bit of complexity now, depending on when the work was created, if it was created in the 30s or 40s or 50s or 60s, whether they actually registered it, whether they actually went and essentially extended their registration. So it's a little tricky in terms of looking at an older work and understanding very quickly when that copyright expires. Generally speaking, if it's before 1923, it's in the public domain. More recently than that, you should probably check with an attorney. If it's since the late 80s or so, it's almost certainly copyrighted. But I would check with an attorney on that because it can become a little bit complex. So as part of that that right given to the copyright owner so they can control the copying, the distribution, the public performance and display, the preparation of derivative work, so translations or adaptations. So if there's a document out there that you feel a need to translate for your own company and you want to translate that and then distribute that, that's a derivative work and you may well need permission for that. And it also gives you the authorization to license other people to do this, and that's where really the licensing piece of this has come in. So why does it matter? Why do we care about copyright? Well, there's several reasons. It is the law, so we pass laws for a reason, and given the history of copyright in this country, the kind of the importance that has been invested in intellectual property, there's certainly a view that there's an important economic reason for this country to respect and promote the creation of intellectual property, especially given how important intellectual property is to our economy today. Certainly, a much bigger share of the economic output of the country than it was years ago when people were laboring in a much more physical way. More, it's also the right thing to do. It's an ethical issue. companies are creating intellectual property, all of us are creating intellectual property all of the time, that system breaks down a little bit if no one is respecting intellectual property. It's really true that without copyright, the publishing industry would not exist. If someone spent years writing a book, only to find that the week after that book is created, somebody could copy that book, bind it, and start selling it at a cheaper price because they didn't have to pay any author royalties on that, the publishing industry would die fairly quickly, and I dare say quite a few people who are authors today would probably look for other lines of work. So there certainly is a right thing to do element, and it does continue to ensure that availability of high-quality content. Again, without copyright, publishing wouldn't exist. There are a couple other reasons to care about copyright, because if you work in a corporation, there's a real incentive to care. And because some publishers over the years have taken a fairly dim view, to say the least, of people violating their copyrights, certainly in any habitual or systematic manner. So just a few examples, kind of starting with the most recent. People heard of the Legg Mason case? How many people have heard of Lowry's Legg Mason? Okay, well, Legg Mason's an investment bank and investment firm, and Lowry's publishes a series of newsletters. One of their newsletters dealt with interest rates, looking at predictions of where interest rates were going. Pretty interesting stuff if you're a Legg Mason. They subscribed to a single copy of that newsletter. I don't know what it cost, maybe $1,000 or something like that. And they proceeded to make that content available to virtually every employee within the company. They'd put it on the internet. They'd make photocopies. They'd just, you know, do it. Lowry's heard about this and tried to kind of say, you know, guys, it's not good. We have site licenses. We have other ways that you can purchase this content and use it throughout your organization. And for reasons that kind of defy logic, the folks at Legg Mason just kept going on. And, of course, they were ultimately sued for this. And the judge's award was $20 million. It was subsequently settled for a confidential sum, but the word on the street is around $10 million. So that was an expensive copyright infringement. They paid a lot to copy that content. The Texaco case goes back another decade or so. Again, fairly systematic copying by researchers. The American Geophysical Union sued Texaco. That case was in the courts for a number of years, but there was a seven-figure settlement and a lot of money in legal fees. Kinko's is more in the academic environment. I suspect if you deal with course packs in any way, you have some familiarity with that case. Kinko's was producing course packs, again, not paying licenses. They were sued by Basic Books. They paid fines, a lot of lawyers' fees, and they actually got out of that business for a while, and they've only recently returned. Yes?
I have heard that somebody willingly or willfully ignored or infringed on somebody's copyright, not only are there large fines, there's a possibility of jail time. Has that ever happened?
I don't know if it has. Do you know if it has, Leslie?
I have not heard of any specific cases. If there are or any are being pursued, it would be for not photocopying a newsletter or an article, but for film or music type of CD, DVD piracy. It wouldn't be for the type of illegal uses going on by any of you.
Right. Some people, I think, for the kind of taking the video camera into the movie theater, the pirated copies, and if there was mass production of that, conceivably you could get into somebody might actually take a more criminal approach as opposed to a civil kind of approach on that. John,
isn't it true in the software industry people actually went to jail?
I believe it is true in the software industry.
I'm not,
but I'd have to double check on that, but. So a few common misperceptions. Physical ownership of the CD or the book or whatever it is not the same as owning the copyright to it. Again, if you buy Harry Potter, doesn't mean you can make thousands of copies of Harry Potter. And I think that's fairly self-evident to people here. Registration, as I said, is no longer required, nor is the copyright symbol. People still tend to put it there, but it's not actually legally required. Protection now is automatic from the time a work is created in that fixed form. So when you write the email tomorrow, that you've just created a copyrighted work. Works made for hire. Many of the works produced out of the corporate environment, I suspect many employees sign work for hire agreements with their corporations. Newspaper reporters tend to be employees. Theirs work for hire. So in fact, there the owner is the corporate entity that person works for, not the author. Attribution is not a substitute for copyright permission. It's always nice to give people credit where credit is due, but it is not the same as getting permission to actually reprint something. and publicly available, just because it's free on the web, doesn't mean that it's public domain and that you can therefore go off and copy it and share it as if it were public domain. Oh, there's my clicker. But at the end of the day, copyright isn't only about the law. Yes, there's a legal aspect, but there are many, many other aspects to what drives our views of copyright here in this country, and in fact, what even does drive the law ultimately. Yes, it's about social policy and the public interest, and Congress is involved in those issues all the time. It's about social norms and behaviors. The law reacts over time to new ways that people behave and interact with content. It's certainly driven by technology and innovation, thus all of those headlines up there that are about, you know, very current cases, and in many cases using very current technologies. It's about business models and economic interests. The Term Extension Act of the late 90s, when that term of copyright was most recently extended, it was no secret. That was called the Sonny Bono Act, and that Disney and some of the Hollywood studios were very, very interested in extending copyright terms. So it's not always, well, there are economic interests that come into play. And there are... and the law also, the law ultimately reflects a social balancing of all of these factors. So... Content's changing, though. It's coming in a lot of new forms today. How many people have used Wikipedia in this room? I would say almost everybody. How many have used Encyclopedia Britannica in the last 6 months? All right. So that tells you something about new ways that content is being created. 30,000 unpaid volunteers creating an encyclopedia in a fairly short number of years that has now dwarfs the Encyclopedia Britannica in terms of the depth and breadth of the content. Is it all accurate? No. Are there some entries that you get to that you're kind of left scratching your head saying, well, that seems pretty thin? Sure. But is it always getting better? Yes. And it's going to continue to get better. And clearly people in this room understand that. The Encyclopedia of Life is another very similar enterprise. This was announced about a month ago, and this is a large effort kickstarted by a $10 million grant from the Mellon Foundation to create an online encyclopedia covering the 1.8 million known and named species of plants and animals and insects and all other living things, and to make that content available for free on the web. It will be created by scientists, but it will also have ordinary citizens who have an interest in science creating that content. I don't know how open it will be to just any Tom, Dick, or Harry off the street deciding that they want to kind of go in and muck with the organization of our species. But so I don't know how Wikipedia it's like, but it is certainly based on that same kind of technology. The Yeti crab was discovered a couple of years ago. It's a scary-looking creature, and I don't know how big it is, but I don't think it's too big. And but it's an example of how these pages will look. This is just a demonstration page that they've put up. They estimate that it will take 10 years to complete this. Now, think about this partly from a copyright perspective. I don't know what exactly the rules are going to be around this in terms of for the student writing the term paper and making use of some of these photos. Could they grab a photo and put it in their high school term paper about the Yeti crab? I don't know what the licensing rules will be here. Those will clearly be worked out. But so it presents some interesting challenges there, but it presents some interesting business challenges because there are publishers who make money today publishing books and encyclopedias dealing with species. And so if I were one of those publishers now, I'd be thinking about getting changing my business model. Technology is also making content easier to move around, easier to share. This is a document that I found on the web. It's a press release from the Authors Guild announcing nearly 2 years ago now that they were going to sue Google over the Google Book Search project. This is the authors suing Google. Took a look at it, and an upper right-hand corner of this screenshot of my browser is a little Share This icon. That's a little application that you can download, and if you click that application, what happens is that a window pops up. The main content recedes into the background, and you're presented with a window where you can type in as many email addresses as you want. You can click that you can post this to your MyFace profile or your Facebook page, and you can write a little message to the people that you're sending it to, and you can click and send it off, and this is what comes into your inbox. There's a little thumbnail of the actual article, which is pretty neat. I've never seen that in an email to a friend feature before. And obviously the headline and the link. And below that, the ability to, for that recipient of the content, to in turn share it further to other friends and colleagues. through email or, again, through Facebook or MySpace posting. So it's very viral distribution, very kind of certainly presents some interesting questions around copyright. So Web 2.0, we've all heard about it. These are many of these companies, I suspect, are familiar to you. There are hundreds more, some of them probably less familiar to you. So what is Web 2.0 at the end of the day? Well, it's about user participation and user creation and the ability to for the user control over content. So this is a graph taken from Technorati, which is the dominant search engine in the blogosphere, showing the growth in the number of blogs from 2003, March of 2003, to March of 2007, a four-year span. In that four-year span, we've gone from essentially no blogs to more than 70 million blogs in 4 years. Now, you think that's good. 120,000 blogs are being created every day. That's more than one per second. So that growth is going to keep going and keep going. Eventually it has to stop because there are only so many billions of people on the planet. But at 70 million now, I suspect it has a ways to grow. Those tools on the right, another set of Web 2.0 tools, are essentially RSS readers. There are a number of RSS readers out there. Who uses RSS to keep track of content in their field, have RSS readers of various types? I suspect more of you will very soon. So those are some of the RSS feeders that you can take and make sense of maybe the 10 or 20 or 30 blogs that are of interest to you in your profession or perhaps your social life or hobbies that you have. There's a blog about everything, given that there are 70 million of them. And so you can organize those and kind of get through them without having to go from site to site to site to site. So what are all the creators of these blogs doing? What are their expectations around the content that they are creating? Are they all intending to make money from their blogs? Certainly some are. There are a few prominent bloggers who are actually doing fairly well off the sale of advertisements on their blogs. But by and large, most bloggers are not blogging for money. Most bloggers are blogging for other reasons. Maybe they just love to have their voice heard, or they hope they can have their voice heard. Some of them are perhaps blogging because what they really want is to be noticed by their community. Maybe they're an academic and they want their colleagues to notice what they're doing. So it's a way of just informing their community. Other people might be selling consulting services, or they write books, or they speak. And so the blogs are really a way that they're just trying to get known and get some of their message out there. So they're not too concerned these days in a practical sense with the copyright around their blog. Is their blog copyrighted? Absolutely. Do all of the same rules that apply to Harry Potter apply to their blog? Absolutely. But the social norms are slightly different. And I think that the laws have not necessarily caught up with the social norms yet. So there's some interesting things that are going to develop around here. For some reason, Samuel Johnson's picture refuses to appear on my slides. So he was a little difficult. And as you can see, he had a very clear sense of why people write. No one but a blockhead writes except for money. Samuel Johnson was an 18th century British writer and poet. He was the producer of one of the first dictionaries, kind of a man about town. He was the guy that Boswell followed around for years and wrote a biography of. It's a little bit different today. People aren't writing for money. They're not creating for money in many cases. Flickr is a grand experiment in people creating. They're taking photographs. They're putting them up on the web. And they are sharing those with people. Many of those photographs are actually put there under Creative Commons licenses. I'll mention that in just a sec, a little bit more. But so clearly people are creating for different reasons today. And I think that creates some interesting questions around copyright. So when you bring all this together, what do you have? You have this clash of cultures. YouTube, people are putting their content up there. They're encouraging everybody to share it. And Viacom is suing them for $1 billion because some people have put up clips of The Daily Show or various other clips of Viacom-owned media. And unfortunately, that's really the case. A lot of these new technologies, as fascinating and as useful and as fun as they are, infringe on the rights of one or more stakeholders in this whole community of content creation and consumption. So it's a real battlefield. Alternatives are coming up. The Creative Commons mentioned a minute ago. Again, another kind of hockey stick growth, almost like the growth of the blogosphere. Creative Commons, as I suspect you know, is a licensing regime under which you can pick any one of a number of licenses, attach it to your content, and essentially say that you will provide that content under that Creative Commons license, and that you are almost giving up some of your rights as a copyright owner, not totally giving them up, but you are not asserting all of your rights. So you will let people perhaps copy your content as long as they attribute it to you or share it in a way that doesn't require some form of payment or explicit permission at the time. The number of Creative Commons licenses appended to pieces of content has grown again from zero to more than 140 million today. As best they can track it, there's no database of Creative Commons licenses, but they can track it a little bit by counting the link back to the Creative Commons site. So what lies ahead? Where does this all take us? I think it's just more of the same. Our environment will be increasingly information rich. More people will be blogging. More people will be creating content in a variety of forms. Living documents are increasingly going to replace static documents. Wikipedia is a living document. The Encyclopedia of Life will be a living document. Many, as people start publishing in ways that allow other people to append notes, append suggestions, the author may come back and rewrite sections of that in reaction to almost that conversation that the author is having with the reader, will create the sense of the living document. That creates a challenge for libraries who ultimately are trying to archive knowledge at specific points in time. Well, if the knowledge is never fixed, if the knowledge is always kind of moving in a Wikipedia way, it's a really interesting question for how libraries deal with that. Participation and collaboration are going to be increasingly central, and new tools and techniques will continue to disrupt the status quo. So let's just bring it down to a second around collaboration, because in the corporate environment where you all live, you're spending a lot of money on content. Your employees are using that content very, very intensively from many different sources, and they are sharing it. They're sharing it all the time, 89% sharing documents with colleagues on a weekly basis. Some of that is permitted by one or more of your licenses, but I suspect that some of it probably falls outside the realm of those licenses. That creates a clear copyright challenge, because collaboration and copyright can come into conflict. So again, you have the forwarding of content, you have a lot of knowledge workers starting their search on the web. People are, they're not experts, right? How can you count on them to be that? So they're sharing that content, they think it's okay, and they don't really know what the rules of the road are. We've just tried one approach to this. I think there will be other approaches. We created this product called RightSphere. I suspect some of you know about it. And really, the point was to try to bring some simplicity to this very complex situation. Let people answer that simple question, well, what can I do with this content? Again, to try to encourage collaboration in a way that's consistent with copyright and in a way that increases some awareness among employees. So thanks very much. I'll be happy to answer any questions along the way.
Are these presentations going to be available?
They certainly can be.
Thank you, Bill. I actually had a question, if I may. It's a philosophical one, if you don't mind. And this is the third time I've seen the Encyclopedia of Life this week, and I didn't know about it. How many of you knew about Encyclopedia of Life before? Wow, great. The reason I mention it's philosophical is if you look at this is a biology content, 1.8 million. Organisms eventually, right? 10-year effort. And is it right now free or?
It
will be free. Okay. Let's change a little bit comparison. Let's look at the chemistry area, right? We have a vendor which produces a database that contains registry file, contains millions and millions, probably more than 10 compounds. And instead of images, they have structures, right? And then that content is obviously proprietary. And then use of that database is extremely ranging anywhere from expensive to exorbitant. So I think you know what I'm talking about. So what's happening here? And chemical compounds, why is that copyrighted in biological organisms? It is copyrighted too, but why is it free on one end and why is it so expensive on the other side?
Well, I don't know. Is this on? It's a great question, and I think maybe the biological sciences are merely the first to be disrupted by new technology. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but perhaps other areas of science will be disrupted in similar ways in the future. I don't know. I mean, it takes a long time for all of these things to filter through all of the areas of our of our economy and our areas of interest. I think it's a fascinating, I think the Encyclopedia of Life is fascinating. I think it's wonderful. I think it's just wonderful on principle. And but who knows where this model will go?
Great. Great question. Thank you. I'd like to introduce our second speaker today, Leslie Harris. Leslie is a copyright and licensing attorney who works on legal, business, and strategic issues in the publishing, content, entertainment, internet, and information industries.
You read, I'm going to bring up her slide.
All right, thanks. Leslie's clients range from individuals to governments, associations, unions, and corporations. How many of you are Leslie's client? Oh, great opportunity here. Okay. Leslie began her career in copyright in 1984, working with a lobbying group interested in revising Canada's copyright laws. From 1987 to 1991, Leslie was senior copyright officer with the Canadian government. That's interesting. Did you work with this CanCopy, the licensing? I'm going to put in a plug for you, Bill. We had a CanCopy license until 2 years ago. And what happened was I was carefully reviewing the document from CCC called Multinational Amendment. After reading that, I said, well, wait a minute. Canada's covered. Why do we have to pay twice? So I contacted CanCopy. They said, yeah, it's fine. But just to make sure, we contacted them. My question, I think, ultimately went up to Ed Haber, your general counsel. Fred Haber, I'm sorry. So, see, I was able to save some money. Okay. Leslie's articles and papers are published internationally, and she is the author of the books Canadian Copyright Law and Digital Property, Currency of the 21st Century, and many other publications. She also is the editor of the Copyright News Media Law Newsletter. Did you give this up to everyone? Or?
No, that I have.
Okay, great. By the way, is this a reprint of PDF download? Just kidding. Leslie has spoken at major conferences on copyright in the U.S., Canada, Mexico, England, and Europe, and of course SLA here. And she has involved with SLA's Click University and have taught courses in the past, was in the SLA. And finally, once sitting in a crab house off the Chesapeake Bay near her house, Leslie met a young man with a shaven head. With the words copyright 1969, his birth year, tattooed on his head. Unfortunately, he wouldn't license the rights to a photograph of his head for use in her slides today.
That is a true story. Thank you very much for inviting me here today. Last time I spoke at SLA, unlike Bill, who has spoken every day at least once, was in Toronto, which was that last year or 2 years ago? Yeah, I skipped last year's. Today I hope to provide you with some practical suggestions and tools for finding answers to your copyright questions. I think Bill did an excellent job of providing background on how content is being used now and some of the new copyright issues that we're looking at and also copyright questions. That previous slide was my first. This actually is my last. I'm going to sit down now. See? I'm going to tell you a joke that, if you've already heard, just laugh anyhow. If you ask two lawyers the same question, you often get three answers. And generally, that's the way that copyright answers are. I'm getting used to this new technology here. As you well know, many answers to copyright questions are, it depends, maybe, what are the risks you're willing to take, rather than yes and no answers, which is really what you want and which would make your life a lot easier. There are three things to keep in mind when trying to answer copyright questions. That copyright law is not exact. There are many gray areas. And a lot of what you do depends on the risk that your organization is willing to take. And if you're willing to take no risk at all in many copyright situations, then you will either always be abiding by your CCC licenses, by your digital licenses, or otherwise obtaining copyright permission for specific uses. Now, one thing I find in many of the talks I give is that many non-lawyers are faced with answering questions that they rather refer to lawyers. Do we have any lawyers other than me in this room? So we have a few lawyers. And how many of you as non-lawyers are sometimes asked copyright questions which you rather not answer? Okay. Well, my goal actually today is to provide you with some confidence in answering or dealing with those questions. And the first thing I want to tell you is that obviously you are not alone. Whoops. That's just to see if you're awake. Probably my most important piece of advice today is to be proactive. Don't wait for the question to be asked. You should have tools and procedures in place to answer copyright questions as they arise. And I hope that my next few slides will help you be proactive. You have to know the type of copyright uses and questions that arise in your organization. And if you kept a list of those uses or questions, you'll find generally that they tend to repeat themselves. I just have a few questions here. Are you photocopying materials for in-house seminars? Are your licensed electronic databases used perhaps in your offices around the world or when your employees are traveling abroad? And what is the standard procedure, or do you have a standard procedure for obtaining permissions to use the content of others? An important part of copyright answers is to make sure that you're not alone and to sensitize your senior management in being behind you, whether it's budget, time, whatever you need, whatever sort of resources you need from them. And actually, Bill set out many of the reasons why senior management should be interested, from $20 million law cases to your organization appearing as being unethical if you are sued. Another thing to keep in mind is that your employees or your colleagues want to also be confident in the uses they're making of copyright materials, that they are legal and that they are within any guidelines that you can provide them. In a lawsuit, anyone might be named in that lawsuit. If you are sued, not necessarily going to jail, but you are named in a suit. So you want to make sure that all your uses are within your own copyright guidelines. One basic rule in terms of all of this, and this will soon come together in a five-point tool list I have, is to be aware of copyright principles, which, again, Bill did mention some of them. He was smart not to mention fair use, because that could be a four-day conference. You really do have to know exactly what your CCC license allows you to do and what it does not allow you to do, and the same with any of your digital licenses. And you have to have some compliance procedures in place. Keep in mind that this is not done by you alone. Just because you might go back to your offices tomorrow and say, hey, look, we got to do something with these copyright issues, we have to be proactive, and someone says, yeah, great idea, you do that. That's not how copyright works. Almost everyone in your organization is using copyright materials, as are your customers possibly, or patrons being exposed to these materials, and you have to have an organization-wide compliance procedure in place. Now, my list of tools. And since John said I only have 15 or 20 minutes, my tool list is relatively short. But again, this could go on for days, and there's lots of workshops and seminars online, offline, all over that can help you with these. I'm going to just list them here. One and two, I have a slide on each. And three, four, and five, I'll just make a couple comments on. A copyright officer. How many of you have a single person in your organization who is responsible for coordinating your copyright efforts? Okay, that's not bad. That was maybe, I don't know, 15 people. Hopefully next year at SLA in Seattle, if I get to ask the same question, it'll be double or triple. I think it's really important to have a person, not a lawyer, but to have a non-lawyer copyright officer or whatever name is appropriate, that deals with permissions, that coordinates all the copyright efforts in your organization. Number four, resources. Very important to have your resources in advance, not when the question comes up. I actually brought a bunch of books on copyright for lay people if you want to take a look after the session ends. My column in Outlook this month is just about resources. I think, like I said, it's really important to find the resources that provide you with answers, so when you have the questions, you can quickly look at them. And access to a copyright lawyer. Many of you probably don't have the resources, or often the complaint is the time to wait for a lawyer to get back to you with answers. What I suggest, again, in terms of efficiently using your lawyer time, is to keep a list of questions that arise from time to time and try and meet with a lawyer maybe quarterly. Go over all the questions, keep answers, and you'll find over time that there's less and less questions because, again, the same questions tend to arise. One of the keys to all of this is to have a written policy which is regularly updated, not only to deal with any changes in the law, but also with your uses of copyright materials, because as we just saw, our uses of copyright materials are changing daily, even in the corporate world. You need to distribute your policy, and you need to discuss it. Having a written policy that goes in a binder or goes on your intranet without any sort of education or discussion is going to be useless to you. And, of course, the education, whether it's education of your copyright compliance policy, other written publications, any sort of courses you can attend, whether it's conferences, whether you bring someone in, even just having discussions, a lunchtime discussion once a month or once a quarter to discuss some of these issues. And I'm just going to summarize what the points I've tried to make this afternoon. Be proactive. Sensitize your senior management. Educate your organization at every level on copyright issues. And develop a copyright compliance policy. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Leslie. I can't help but looking at this, and flip to the back, you know, there's a price list, of course, and then it says $149 institutional subscribers in North America. Is this a quarterly or bimonthly or?
A quarterly.
Okay. So, okay, 149 divided by four, let's face it, that's cheaper than a single article, right? Most cases from document delivery vendor, right? About, yes. And then you have this $99 add-on license for print subscribers only. And then, this is the great part, intranet license for PDF newsletters and alerts. So we can literally load this up on the intranet?
That's correct.
And for global use?
Yes, there is a license that goes with that.
Wow.
Though.
See, talk about enlightened publisher. Thank you. So moving... My first question, okay, moving from this reason I asked that question, because it's a newsletter, education, and how many of you have a copy of this? Yes, right? If you can see, right? Copyright training in the corporate world. It's kind of interesting. I didn't pay too much attention. I did read the article, but I didn't pay too much attention about the author, and I was talking to Bill Monday. I said, wow, that's a pretty well-written article, and Bill told me that it's written by?
Doug Black, who's our public relations manager.
Right, great. So,
who's been a journalist in his career, so he writes well.
Right. So my first question has to do with, you know, the education, I guess, especially for corporate librarians like us, not the lawyers, they already know. If you look at the scene currently, there's several options. Obviously, they are traditional classroom type, you know, teaching, whether it's by Leslie or Laura Gassaway. Everybody knows Laura Gassaway, right? So we have those options of, I guess, a classroom type, right? And then I understand Laura goes around the country. Do you do that too, Leslie, you know, to teach courses, classroom?
I do some. I actually teach six online courses for SLA through ClickQ.
See, that's great. See, great key online courses. And Bill, you mentioned that
we're doing a great many webinars for our corporate clients and a lot of and academic training all around the country.
And I think there are several other sites. And the one I just discovered yesterday, I don't know whether any of you have heard it, it's called ipshield.com. Any of you heard of that? It's the company is founded by a former, I think, president of senior management staff of IHS, Information Handling Service, John Toth, T-O-T-H. And, you know, I didn't even know about it, so I accessed the site last night, looked around, and then, you know, yet again, it's very focused for web-based training, e-learning, that kind of thing, you know, and it's to see copyright going to that kind of level, open access to everybody, you still have to pay, but, you know, fairly inexpensive, I think it's great. So my question to both of you is, what do you think that the future of education in copyright obviously should be important, but without becoming a lawyer taking these, you know, many courses, what would be the most effective way to become more, I guess, an expert?
I think variety and quantity. Some people call me an expert, but I feel like I'm still always learning about copyright, and it's a continuous process. You can really never know enough. Sometimes you know what you don't know, and that's also very important. And because there's so many different ways you can learn about copyright from some of these books I brought along, including one by Laura Gasway, which is excellent. I say just keep taking, read books, read newsletters, read lots of online articles, attend sessions at conferences, take advantage of every opportunity that you can. And also keep in mind it's not always the lawyers who know everything about copyright. Often a librarian who works full-time in licensing digital content is actually going to be able to provide you with a lot more practical advice than a lawyer. So look towards different people with different backgrounds for that information.
So to help answer that, I have a question. How many people in this room have an MLS? All right. So put your hands down. How many of you, as part of your degree process or in some other formal way, something more than this, have had what you would think of as a significant amount of copyright training or training in licensing? All right, that's very consistent with a session last year that I was on in Baltimore where someone asked the same question. That to me suggests that MLS programs need to include some serious copyright education and training as a part of that program. I just think it's fundamental. Just fundamental.
Just to add to that, it's surprising to me that there aren't more copyright courses in the MLS programs. Why? I mean, the copyright issue for librarians has been around for decades, really.
Yes. I'm aging myself. What? I think there's a relationship to the years and the trend of the age of the librarians who are in here, because as you stated in your presentation, copyright has just become an issue recently within the last 10 years. So it's depending on how young the librarians are or how old or how mellow we are in relationship to...
Well, I hope you're right. And it's certainly the case that it is a hotter issue today, and so there's a greater imperative to have some formality of training around that today. I don't know if there are any recent graduates in the room who can illuminate us on that.
Well, I'd like to say, as a recent graduate, we do cover the topic, but it's also, and I'm a law librarian, there's an issue of interpreting the law that falls to lawyers and not the librarian.
Oh, absolutely.
Raya, you had a question?
I just wanted to say, people take courses so that they can make money and make a living. They're going to learn how to do a search or how to work in a medical library, not how to do this.
If you could, I just want to rotate back and forth because I had to collect all the questions, you know, before the session. My second question has to do with the role of information professionals on copyright within our corporations. In conjunction with our effort, I guess, to make MLS a more visible degree and have more impact within our corporations, I know we're all trying hard. In my case, I used to work for Wyeth and Baxter, and now with Gilead. I have established personal relationship with Intellectual Property Council, and you know we have this, the lady over there is an opinion providing role. However, if you look at least within the biopharmaceutical industry corporations, the IP department, their first priority, absolutely by far highest, is patents, right? The next is trade secrets and trademark, maybe third. If you're lucky, copyright is third. And copyright is usually at the bottom. And in general, my instructions or instructions from them to me are something like, well, you should know your stuff. You know, you're a librarian. There's a published literature, digital otherwise, you know, hard copy. Just don't get us into trouble. So I like to pose that question to both of you. You know, what should be the ideal role of information professionals within our corporations? How can we get to that perhaps elevated level?
Sure. I think I mentioned that briefly in my presentation. More the role of coordinator of information and copyright resources rather than providing legal advice. None of you want to provide legal advice, but by having someone in each organization at least coordinate the efforts, so the marketing department knows what the research department is doing, what the resource center is doing, I think that's essential. But by no means do you have to be an expert in copyright law and just have access at least from time to time to copyright lawyers.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think there's a kind of a level of lay knowledge of the law, knowing that something as basic as just because it's on the web doesn't mean it's public domain. It's something that many of your employees may not understand, but that's a level of understanding you can clearly bring to the table. You will need to have effective partnerships with your own legal department. That may involve some education of your legal department in terms of the importance of this, and so I think that level of partnership with legal is an important and necessary thing, because some of the questions will get into some fair use applications and ultimately some judgments will need to be made around levels of risk acceptance, and that becomes in some cases a senior management decision.
Thank you.
My question has to do with we're covering with Copyright Clearance Center, we know about licenses and those kinds of things. Stuff that concerns me are the things related to the intranet, let's not even go to the public website, intranet, deep linking to articles. Nobody seems to, at least nobody in our firm, no matter how many times I bring it up, the whole issue of deep linking, I never see that showing up easily in documents and examples of copyright policies. If you look at some websites are very good, and they'll tell you, no deep linking. You want a deep link, and if you're in a business, contact us. But many of them don't, and we know that deep linking violates, in most cases, violates websites. What's going on with the whole, on an intranet perspective, for-profit, corporate-wide, what are the guidelines? Are there any? I haven't read through the article in any information about that.
Well, an intranet is a redistribution just like the internet. It just doesn't reach as many people. So I think that many of the same rules apply. And the deep linking issue, you have an interesting point of view on that. I'm not so sure it's always so clear. So I think there has not been much case law, if any interesting case law in the U.S. There have been some things going on in Europe around deep linking. I can't venture a view on that. Again, there's probably some level of your own lawyers need to kind of interpret and weigh what they view as your risk on that. I think it's deep linking. The one thing I will say, it's not as clear cut as a lot of other kind of clearly consumptive copying.
As an FYI, some online publishers are actually spidering the web, and if you have deep linking on your public website, they find you, and they hit you with extensive high fees. So on your public website, if you have some deep linking...
Are these two subscription protected products?
No, these are free things on the web. But if, in fact, you deep link to an article, some publishers on their terms of use actually say, if you want a deep link to your intranet or to your internet, to any of our stuff that's out on the web, there are fees attached to it. So you might want to think and be forewarned. That's happening to some of us. I wasn't involved in it, I just heard
as your new lawyer in those situations. You don't always have to pay those fees. You can ignore them, and et cetera, et cetera. In the United States, there are no court cases on deep linking. There have been cases that have been settled out of court, And that's often what organizations are following, and they're not deep linking because of those cases. So it really is up to your organization, in part, as Bill says, a risk assessment. But I will tell you my own personal belief. I have a brand new web page now, but before my website was completely hacked and disintegrated a few weeks ago, I had deep links in my own site for which I did not get permission. So for my situation, at least, I felt comfortable. But that's not to say you feel comfortable. I am my own corporation, and you have to go by your organization's policies. But that's an excellent example. If it's written in your copyright policy, everyone will know what's allowed and what's not. And that's what you're trying to do. You're trying to have some sort of guidelines so it's easy. Whether or not it's an exact interpretation of how the law will be, or just a risk assessment and just trying to avoid a hassle, like a letter saying, please, or not even please, just stop doing that. That's the role of copyright guidelines and a policy.
Just a personal, not a legal view on this. If publishers really want to prohibit deep linking, there are ways to dynamically generate URLs that essentially make it impractical for anyone to put a link that deep links. So if they're really serious about it, there are ways to defeat it. And I would also just point out that Google has more than a few deep links in their index. And I don't know how many of those letters they get.
Bill, you know, rather than deep linking, let's even on the public website, actually obtaining the article and make it available, and within your transaction reporting system, you can obtain those rights with pricing, correct? I mean, isn't that the case?
Right, for what, John? I'm sorry?
To post articles on public-facing internet. I know intranet. It's fine, but...
Not in TRS. And we have another service where you can,
okay,
if the publisher has given us the permission to sell that right.
Okay. Just one. Gentlemen in the back, please.
Yeah, I have a general question about, say, I work for an environmental consulting firm, and there are publications you get, like compilations of standards from various organizations. And you have a copyright clearance license to use these materials. And if you buy a book that has a compilation of standards in it, and there's a particular standard in this, I presume for fair use that you can make a copy and the book and the publisher's covered under the is included in the repertory. You can make a copy of that standard internally for your organization and distribute. But if you get an electronic copy of that particular, say, an individual standard, it's the same thing as in that book. But there's various ways to get it. You can get it from directly from, say, ESPN, or you can get it from one of the other vendors like TextStream or IHS. But that, you know, there's various formats of it, and there's a prohibited license restriction when you get it digitally. But you've also, if you get it in the paper book, are you entitled to fair use distribution of that?
So this is one of those "it depends" or "I don't know" answers.
Is it copyright clearance center license?
We do have standards. Standards are, and I can only say a little about this because I've only, in the last couple of days, I gather there's some interesting questions that have been coming our way about standards. And so, to be perfectly honest, I need to go back and probably spend a little time with our attorney so that I can accurately represent how we deal with standards. One of the issues with standards is that a standard is considered a full work under the terms of our license. And so it looks like just a little thing, but it is the whole thing. And so I'd be happy to get more information to you on that. If you want to give me your card, I'll be happy.
Well, you have compilation books.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I would like to ask a question. Leslie, would you like to comment on that? That he had this about standards.
No, because he's asking, I think, about the CCC license. So.
Okay. can I ask a question? We're going back and forth, if I may. The next question has to do with what I consider as a liberalization of copyright. And as an example, again, I do apologize. This is more relevant for pharmaceutical industry, specifically medicine. How many of you did receive the handouts? It's the NEJM, Active Use License. Okay.
Reactive use,
I'm sorry. Thank you. How many of you know what NEJM is? New England Journal of Medicine, right? Okay. What happened was that if you look at the date, it actually says February 15th, 2007, already signed. And I had to sort of delete, you know, the company. It's not us, by the way. In any event, there's a very interesting clause. How many of you have a New England Journal of Medicine site license? Okay, well, I believe many of you have site license to other publications too, but NEJM is definitely one of the best clinical journals. There's a clause in here which says, basically if you have already a corporate license, then I'm not going to read all the details, but it allows the license holder, in this case any of us, to send out on a one-on-one basis. What does that mean? A consumer, healthcare professional, a pharmacist, ask questions. Well, Mr. Chu, the Gilead's drug X, was, I understand it's published recently in New England Journal of Medicine, was this kind of a safety profile. I'd like to know more about it. When we get that, we literally can immediately send out through PDF attachment email, and the greatest thing about this is it's free, number one. Number two, it's global in scope. You can send to anywhere in the world. So to me, that represents another enlightened publisher. And so my question to both Leslie and Bill is that, do you think the trend of the publishers is to allow this kind of more liberalized copyright?
Well, I think it's a more liberal license, not copyright. That's why we changed copyright. I think it looks on the face value like a terrific thing. And I think enlightened is a pretty good way to describe it, innovative. But essentially what they're doing is what we try to do is to meet those changing needs of content users. And so, from what I can see here, it looks like a wonderful thing.
Leslie?
I agree. And I think the important thing here, too, is that often when you are offered different licenses, I don't know if this is true of CCC, but definitely any digital content licenses, if they don't meet your needs, you need to tell the vendor or publisher or database owner. Many people or librarians come to me and say, oh, I didn't think it was negotiable. Well, as we all know, almost everything in life is negotiable. And whether you use the words negotiation or just letting the other side know, it doesn't work. I think we'll see more clauses that work to meet your needs. And also, just in fairness for the other side and what Bill mentioned in his presentation, is publishers do have to make a living so they can continue to publish. So yes, they may be able to provide you with some free uses, but in their licenses, what they can provide you is the uses that you need for the money you're already paying them for.
Thank you. Lady in green, you had a question? Please.
Could you go to the
microphone, please?
I'm the president of a consortium of standard users right now, particularly aerospace standard users, and all we deal with is standards. And while I'm not really sure exactly how CCC and standards work, when I've talked with the SDOs, they really don't care if you have a CCC or not. They want you to pay for everything you buy from them. And as far as making copies, again, I would just say it's amount of how much risk you want. You can look up under ASTM, one of their executives is John Pace. He's written a lot of information on digital rights management, and they are introducing a lot of locking to their standard. So I would warn anybody on a standard, do not photocopy it and do not put it on your intranet and do not disperse it email, because they are actively looking for people that are doing that. And they will give you a warning first, but I'd be just very cautious about it. Again, it's risk, how much risk you're willing to take. But they're really working on the digital rights management.
Thank you. Did you exchange a business card with that gentleman?
I haven't yet, but I will. I do have a question for Leslie. Leslie, I've been to several of the copyright seminars that we've had here, and so far I've not heard anybody mention the word ITAR, which is a big buzzword with corporate America.
What is it? Sorry?
It's called ITAR, I-T-A-R, and I can't remember what exactly those letters stand for, but it's International Trade Restrictions. And what that has to do with is, if, especially in corporate America, in the defense world, if you have some information that is not, it's not classified secret, it's not classified as protected, but if there is technical information that cannot, according to the laws of Congress, cannot be distributed to certain company, to certain countries. And so I just wanted to mention this today for those of you that are corporate. It's another layer on top of copyright. I have to check every time I send. I've got employees that are in Korea, and before I can send any information to my L3 employees in Korea, I have to check with our ethics officer, simply because they are in Korea. They're in another country besides the United States. So that adds an increasingly more complex layer on top of all the copyright laws underneath that.
Okay, Miss.
I was
going to
add a comment about the New England Journal licensure. Concept-wise, it's great, but look into the cost of it. Because we tried to do it for our institution, and I'm a small medical library, and the cost just couldn't fit into our budget to have that type of licensure. So
yeah.
We just paid as...
Okay, yeah. Can I make a comment, sort of counter-argument? We are a for-profit pharmaceutical company, and we are obligated to respond to the questions from outside. That's why most of our companies have something called Medical Communications Department, RIER, right? You have it too, right? The reason I'm pointing out is you told me you signed that license. So these departments are housed by PharmDs and MDs, and they have the obligation to actually answer questions. And the librarians actually do online searching to support these clinicians, we call them. So that's one reason. Another reason is most of our companies have something called MSLs, Medical Science Liaisons. They're, again, PharmD, MDs, and they don't exactly go and sell, okay? But they talk to at the conferences, hospitals, anytime, anywhere about the drugs, science, safety, efficacy, compliance. And those people have indicated that when they receive these questions, even at the conference, if they can immediately, at the exhibit booth, like the ones you went, print a copy, because it's one-on-one, right? It's the NEJM license does not allow for, like, you know, print 20 copies and distribute. That's not allowed. So I guess it has to do with the motivation and effect. I agree with you. It's cost, you know, it's very expensive. Those medical communication staff, they get paid a lot. So it's a sort of different, you know, motivation and why we need to do that, the drug companies. Thank you. Any other questions, please? Yes, ma'am.
Do you, as the university,
as a staff member
of an academic institution who creates copyrighted materials?
Course outlines.
Kinko.
I don't really know. I don't think I could answer that, because I don't necessarily know what the legal nature of your employment might be with the university. If you're a staff member or if you're a faculty, are there general agreements that the university may have with its faculty and staff around ownership of those things? Well, we know if a faculty member writes a book, the university typically does not own the copyright to the book. That's I would find that extraordinary if that happened. So
my problem
comes in course on clients.
Course out, right. So I don't know. I don't know why. I think you'd have to get some answer from the legal counsel of the university in that regard. I couldn't necessarily give you a legal opinion in that instance.
Leslie?
I can deal with the principal generally. If the faculty member is an employee and part of the duties is to create course outlines and course materials, then the university would likely own that content. But I can't say for sure because, as Bill said, there might be other agreements in place. There might be a collective agreement. There might be a specific employment agreement. But as a general principle, any employee who creates something as part of their employee duties, that the owner of that content is the employer or the university.
That's kind of interesting because, you know, again, drug company, if a sales director come up with an outline of a business strategy, no question who owns it, not him.
Yeah, but it's like Bill said, if it's a book, that would likely be outside the scope of the duty. So you have to see what's within the scope of the duty and what's expected and when it's created, how it's created, and all of that. So it's not a simple situation and goes much back to my presentation, which it depends on all of the circumstances.
And into the social norms of the academic environment where social norms might are important.
Lady in pink, please.
That's true.
Just because it's on the web doesn't mean that it's in the public domain. But if I go to USA Today and there's a thing that says email this, is that implying that they've given permission to email it to somebody else?
It's implied that it's explicit, not implied, that they've given you permission through that service to email, using that service, the link to a friend. And the reason they've done that is not because they don't care about their copyright on that article. They've done that because their business model has been structured around ad impressions. And so what that email to a friend tool generates is a link sent through an email, and if the recipient wants to view the article, they click on the link and a new ad impression is created for that new reader. So it facilitates USA Today's business model, and since it's their content, they're certainly free to do that. Now, if you were to alternatively cut and paste the content from USA Today and send it in an email via your Outlook email client, that would be a very different matter because you're essentially robbing USA Today of that ad impression, which is how their business is set up.
And so it doesn't matter if I'm sending it to my attorney and he might cite that and accuse that he's used. It doesn't matter why he's going to read the article?
You'd have to look at their terms and conditions. Some publishers might have different terms and conditions over sending content for professional or commercial uses versus personal uses. I couldn't venture a guess. There might be some terms and conditions, or there might not. But in general, that they are trying to get ad impressions around that link.
Leslie, would you like to comment on that?
On that one, I agree. I would call it actually implied permission, but either way, you have permission there. You can't really use it in any other manner. Even though you can email it to someone, you can't, let's say, post it on your intranet. It's a very specific use there.
We have time probably for about two or three more questions.
One, I think.
Yes. Sorry, last question. Go ahead. Oh. Yeah, go ahead.
That's a technical question.
Oh, that's a technical question. Yeah, Okay, then.
And you can also email me and probably Bill directly if they're easier to find just by emailing
us. Any other burning question? Go ahead.
In our licenses, in our terms and conditions, we began a couple years ago putting in terms and conditions with what we call the regulatory. Mm-hmm. Is there anything
if that's not a clause that's included, will we submit the rights to continue to operate if required?
Yes.
But those documents, is there any kind of that's still open to? So typically we get copies of articles and don't want the subscriptions from document delivery providers.
Right.
They don't pay the copyright.
Right.
However, many times we're getting things from universities that are very unique publications, and it's not always easy to nail down the rights holder.
Well,
probably in most cases we're at minimal risk, but
if you have a CCC license, the regulatory submission is covered by our license.
If you acquired,
well, it has to be listed.
Yeah, see, some of these are not.
Right, some of them are obscure.
I understand.
Right, okay. So I
probably the risk is minimal, but I didn't know if there was any kind of general.
I don't know. Yeah, it's not covered. I can appreciate the dilemma because the rights holder could be hard to find.
Or it could be orphaned.
Right, who knows?
Just before everyone leaves, if anyone does want to look at some copyright resources, some books I brought for non-lawyers, please come up when the session ends.
Thank you very much. Let's have a round of applause for the speakers.
Beyond the Book is an educational presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center, with conferences and seminars featuring leading authors and editors, publishing analysts, and information technology specialists. Beyond the Book is the premier source for knowledge on the latest business issues facing today's dynamic publishing industry, from initial research to final publication and beyond.